There we go. So once again, we have one person in the live discussion, but it's a different person each time.
We're taking turns.
Yeah, you're taking turns. It's almost like it's organized. So we might have more people join us. Who knows? I only just put out the tweet. I mean, I mentioned it earlier, and of course it's in the course description and all, and you found it, but a lot of times people wait and don't join until they see something at the last minute that suggests that they could join. So anyhow, welcome to the course, and welcome to this particular part of the discussion. This is the Module 2 introductory discussion, but this is your first time joining us, so why don't I start to see if you have any reactions to the course so far?
I do have reactions. The most important reaction, I think, for me is that I keep chewing on the word ethics, not necessarily relating to learning analytics, maybe in a broader sense of analytics, but I keep chewing on the word ethics, and I think you've either said this or alluded to this, that it's not a thing, right? It's almost like a process, and it's almost like it changes depending on context and time. My background is in first career was healthcare, so I will always go back to do no harm. My second career was in academe, and I did do research, I found that ethics always changed depending on the type of research that I did. If I were doing research with community groups or especially marginalized groups, I really felt that research ethics was a negotiation, that it was a conversation, that you had at the beginning, but it kept going all the way through. And what was an interesting part of it was to look at the data that you collected and who it belonged to, which really left an impression on me in terms of ethics. How could I guarantee, let's say, that I would do no harm when ultimately, I don't know what the result of the research is when I start it. So how can I guarantee that? Right? I can't. So when I have something, I have to share it with the people that I do research with. And what if they say they will be harmed if let's say I publish this. Do I not publish?
Well, that's a good
so
question.
It becomes, it's this conversation that happens over and over and over and over. And that's what I think about ethics. And I think about it, it's the same thing in many ways in everyday life. It's a moving target. It's something that emerges. So one of the things that you said that quite interested me was to look at it from, let's say, the lens or the view of a mesh.
Right.
And I'm trying to grapple with ethics and mesh, and what I've just said are my beginning thoughts on it. And then trying to look at it in terms of learning analytics.
Because learning analytics, that learning analytics and digital analytics in general add a whole new dimension to this. Certainly in terms of the scale, for example, how do you negotiate with 100 million people?
Exactly. I did research, some time ago, I did observations on Usenet. I'm sure mm-hmm. you remember Usenet.
Oh yeah.
And how do you get permission? How do you, et cetera, in terms of a public, open, online discussion forum? How do you get it?
Oh, Twitter, good example.
Yes. Yeah. So. So anyway, that's where I'm at, and I look forward to, discussion, blogs, etc., because I think it'll probably get me closer to this amorphous mesh that I'm trying to put together.
Yeah, it's interesting, and I'm glad I have the live transcription running so that I can capture and steal your thoughts, because I have no shame. A lot of what you said about the process and the conversation actually anticipates where this course is going to by the time we get to Unit 8. So I find that quite interesting. But the, to me, huge question that the digital analytics brings up is, well, as Carl Sagan once said, who speaks for us? In a number of ethical codes, and preparing for this, I read dozens and dozens and dozens of them. We have a whole section on them later, a whole module on them. A number of them say, well, there is no practical way to get permission from people, so we just assume we have it. which struck me as pretty convenient and maybe a little bit self-serving. And it's interesting, you also raised the question of ownership of data. And we see again, companies out there saying, there's no practical way that people could own their own data, so we own it. And again, that's pretty convenient. Or at the very least, companies are saying, we have a perpetual, no limit, non-exclusive, or in some cases exclusive, right to use this data. It's yours, but we can do anything we want with it, which ultimately ends up including transfer ownership of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
that happens a lot.
Yeah. And I guess the presumption is that's unethical, but on what basis? Because we've never had this question come up before in society. Just hasn't come up. It's new, and that's what's really interesting to me. So one of the things I wanted to do at the beginning of Module 2, which is now, was to see if you're using artificial intelligence in your daily life now, in any way. So I wonder about that. Can you think of any uses that you're currently making?
Artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
That I'm using or is being used on me?
I'm thinking more specifically of you using them. I mean, we can imagine the other case pretty easily, but...
Yeah. Not a lot. Not at the moment.
Yeah.
No. Certainly in the past, I've taught online,
Right.
so various kinds of dashboards where you could see when students participated or didn't participate, or how many likes they gave something or not. So that would be probably the most recent.
Yeah. I'd classify all of that under the heading of descriptive analytics. Indications of how many visits you've had, how many tweets there have been, perhaps even scores people got on their tests, which you can see in a dashboard or a presentation or a nice pie chart or whatever. That's pretty common.
But I also want to say that I did not necessarily use those.
Yeah, that's
However,
interesting.
my institution probably did.
And that creates a case of them using it on the students and it being used on them. One area where I've used this quite a bit is in the area of physical activity. And as you can see, I need physical activity. And I used to use an application called RunKeeper. And now I use an application called Strava, not because I run, but I do other activities. I do hiking and I do quite a bit of cycling. And Strava in particular, which is why I use it now, it shows me my routes, it shows me my time, it shows how much elevation I gained, a bunch of related statistics. And I find that really an interesting use of analytics. It's not artificial intelligence per se yet, but it's definitely in the realm of analytics, I would think. So, do you?
And actually, I do use things like that. So Fitbit or Google Fit or
Yeah. So there's something. What would you think if, I'm just thinking out loud here, this isn't part of a plan. If one of these applications chirped or whatever and said, okay, go out and exercise now.
Actually, it does chirp to me when I sit for too long.
Okay.
But I can ignore it really well.
Yeah. Yeah. That's probably a good thing, having that choice and not having to. Yeah. So, and in my power bill, I'm based in Ontario here, and they've got analytics, and I don't get this anymore because I told them to stop. But they've got analytics that actually break down how much power I'm using on heating, how much power I'm using for the refrigerator, how much power I'm using for what they called always on applications. I'm not sure what they meant, but probably my computer. And that can be useful, although I thought that was kind of invasive.
Yes.
Yeah. Where are you based?
Toronto.
You're in Toronto, okay. So, yeah, you probably. I get my power from Ottawa Power, so obviously you're getting yours from a different company, probably Ontario Hydro or something, which
Yes,
is.
yeah. And
Yeah.
it doesn't break it down like that. It's more a comparison to last year.
Okay. Well, it's a minimal kind of analytics, I suppose. It is a comparison, then you can draw your own conclusions. I'll bet I can beat that for next year.
I see. The power company's trying to game me.
I'm sure they are. And but I just don't know which direction they're trying to game you into, right? More consumption or less? So, if they're one of these companies that loses money with each unit sold, then they probably want you to use less, so they lose less money. We're using analytics right here, actually, in this session, because I have the live transcription turned on, which means that there's analytics interpreting my voice and turning that into text, which I still think of as a miracle. I've been testing different types of this over the last number of weeks and months. So the best one I found was something called Otter.ai, which did a really nice, nice conversion of text or speech to text. But it's a private company and you have to pay them money. So yeah, I got to try it for 3 times and then now it wants money from me and I'm too cheap to give money for the mere convenience of turning audio into text, even though it's a miracle. That's funny. I just saw the transcription here. It said, even hooks are a miracle. So, yeah, it wasn't very good. And so these Zoom meeting transcriptions, generally they haven't been bad. It's interesting to watch it correct itself as I'm speaking. I don't know if you're seeing the transcription right in front of you.
No, I'm not.
Should be able to see it. Maybe do you see the, do you have a CC button?
Oh. Oh, wait a second, I do.
Try clicking that.
Okay, view full transcription, I see it.
There we go. But it said beautiful transcription rather than view full transcription.
Yes.
So maybe it has an attitude.
Just to say.
Yeah. So, and I use on my phone, my old Henry bar has stuck to my phone. This was lunch. Well, I foolishly scheduled these at noon. I don't know what I was thinking. So what we've got here going, up higher. Okay.
Yeah.
This is on my Google Pixel 4 phone. And it does a live transcription as well. I don't know if you're seeing it real time.
I can't really read it. No, it just blurs.
Yeah, it just blurs. That's too bad. Yeah, too bad. I don't have a better camera, but that's the trade-off. If I had a better camera, then I'd be using more bandwidth, and then I might get stuttering images. And so it's recording the actual audio, and in real time, it's transcribing it to text.
And is it pretty good?
It's not bad. It's not quite as good as Otter, but it's better than the other types of... we got a person. We have Tim Tupper coming and joining us.
Okay.
So it's better than the other types I've tried. I've also tried... The transcription in Microsoft Teams and also Microsoft Word. Word is nice because you can just click a button that's on the ribbon bar that says dictate. And then if you're using the online version, I don't think it works on the... it doesn't work on the desktop. Oh no, this is my... So anyhow, it's also in PowerPoint, and I assume it's on the online version, but not on the desktop. Oh, and we've got someone else coming in. So, this looks like Mark.
Yep.
Maybe? No, I don't know. Because he's just an image now, so there's no name, and I think we've lost Tim. I guess I should have been more welcoming. I didn't want to interrupt what we were doing to welcome him, and I just thought, well, you can join in on the fly, and then we lost him.
Mark is connecting to audio.
Okay. So we're getting there.
I'm in.
He's in. Okay. He's in with his LA hat. But I don't know that he's wearing it right now. He's probably not feeling great at the moment. But anyhow, the nice thing about the Windows one, or sorry, the Microsoft Word one, is I can just import an audio file. And then it takes a few moments, but it'll convert that. It's not bad. Not quite as good as Google, but pretty good. And I've used that as a transcription source as well. So I think those are the main ones that I've used. I don't do anything with Apple. I have no idea whether Apple has transcription audio to text or not.
I'm not sure either. I don't use Apple very much.
Yeah.
Actually, I don't even know how to use the desktop of Apple. So.
Yeah. I swore off all Apple products. I guess it was a while ago now. I forget how long it was. just because they were so concerned about locking you into this single product ecosystem.
Yeah.
And
yeah, that's basically why, you know, I have not really engaged with them.
Yeah.
And plus they're, you know, they lock everything down.
Yeah.
You can't do anything.
Yeah.
Which irritates me because they've taken away my choice and I don't like that.
Exactly. We come back to choice again. Mark, we were I was asking whether you're using artificial intelligence in your daily life. So I wonder, can you think of any ways you might be, or not just artificial intelligence, but even analytics in general?
Other than being in the Google ecosystem, not consciously using it, no. I actually object to the term artificial intelligence. I wish they'd picked a different term. But anyway,
it's probably not the best term, is it?
No, well, you know, it's gets to that. Do you believe there's a universe or multiverses? And I'm one of those that thinks there's just one big thing, and so intelligence is everywhere, and none of it's artificial.
Okay.
Anyway, yeah, so. But analytics, I guess, would be the term I'd reach for. I want to learn to use analytics consciously and non-discriminatorily. If I'm going to use it, I want to, you know, use it consciously. So that's where I'm at. I'd like to use it, but not yet.
I'm watching the automated transcription happening here in Zoom, and it said, and it interpreted what you said as not from Laura Lee. So you should be able to see the transcription on the screen. There's a live transcript CC or closed caption button in Zoom. It's on the bottom a little bit to the right.
Actually, mine's floating up on the top.
Oh, okay.
Or maybe that's just a notification. Page.
Yeah, maybe it's just telling you that.
It's right at the bottom where there's chat,
yeah,
share screen.
Yeah, okay, yeah, that was a notification floating on the top. Now I
right.
Okay.
So there you go. Now you're using artificial intelligence or analytics. It's funny. When you said you didn't like the term artificial intelligence, I thought your complaint would be with the term intelligence, and not with the term artificial. So it's quite interesting.
I could reach for that too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the search for intelligence continues.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's an interesting point, and I guess it is a theoretical perspective that you might or might not take as to whether intelligence is something that is limited to humans, or at the very least life forms as opposed to machines, or whether any system properly constructed could have intelligence. And the same sort of question gets raised a lot with respect to other things. For example, consciousness. Could there be such a thing as machine consciousness? Perception, feeling, sensation. There's the whole list of attributes of thought that humans have that we've categorized over time and that we all have experience having. And we think, some people think that they're unique to humans and others not so much. And actually, I fall in the not so much camp myself. Perhaps in the sense of perceptual feel. Like what Thomas Nagel once wrote an article called "What is it like to be a bat?" And he asked the question, what does it feel like to perceive the world the way a bat does? And the answer essentially is, well, we can't know. We're not bats. And you actually have to be a bat to know what it's like to be a bat. And so perhaps, what is it like to be a robot is also something that we can't know. And what is it like to be a human is something a machine can't know. But that's not what intelligence is. And it's not even what analytics is. And the term intelligence is too broad for what we're doing now, I would say. In the synopsis, I broke it down into six categories. I stole from Gartner, again, because I have no shame. There's a Gartner categorization, which is, see if I can remember it, because it's not right in front of me. Descriptive analytics, which is where we started, Sherida, looking at, these systems that produce dashboards for us. There's diagnostic analytics. I see that Zoom spelled both pronunciations the same way. That's pretty good. Where we're doing some sort of an interpretation or inference. For example, maybe clustering, regression, classification. Then there's predictive analytics, which is, as the name suggests, right, predicting what's going to happen. And then prescriptive analytics, which Gartner says is something like, how can we make something happen? And that makes sense, but I didn't think it was sufficient coverage. Because I went through and I'm one of these completionists, so I just tried to read everything. And you can't read everything, but that doesn't stop me from trying. And I ended up with two more categories. One which I called generative analytics, which is the use of AI systems and especially neural nets to create new content. You may have seen this is not a person, and it's images of people that are artificially generated. Or there's an application, GPT-3, which finishes poems for you, writes songs. Somewhere out there, there's a 24/7 all automated death metal generator, which actually isn't bad, but you know, you get tired of it after a little while. So I added that category, and then I also added a category that I called deontic analytics. And that was analytics that tell us what things should be. For example, analytics that tell us what's fair, analytics that tell us what's ethical, analytics that tell us, what principles we should use in order to divide resources, etc. There's a bunch of different applications that I found. So that's the categorization I used. It's purely arbitrary in a certain sense. I was thinking about it today, and I was thinking, what is the basis for that? And it's actually, linguistically based, right? There's present tense, there's future tense, there's different modalities, like what's possible, what's probable, and then you go into what should be. So, maybe. I don't know, what do you think of that? How would you categorize if you had the option? Or what's missing? Hard question.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, this is certainly not the field I'm that familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to cover from the past to the future, as you pointed out. So, I guess by defining these categories of analytics, what it points to, for me, what it then points to is what's the human experience in relation to these. So, given that these are different ways of looking, non-human, machine-based, or however you want to say it, silicon-based ways of looking at things, then to me it points back at me to say, okay, how do I operate differently? Because I'm always, I have a friend who's a well-known poet, regional poet here in Los Angeles, and I've watched him, off and on, basically his whole life, struggled to string words together. And then now we have these machines string words together. And so I'm okay, and not being a linguist or a professional poet, I could see where they look very similar. The results look very similar. Yet one is from a lifetime of trying to communicate between humans, and one is a new and shiny random generator. Not random, I guess.
Yeah, not random, yeah.
Machine generator, yeah. And to me, they look very similar, and yet I have a feeling, a suspicion, that they are a very different product. But I've been wrong before.
That's an interesting question. So I'll pose this to Sharita. Can you imagine a machine doing the work that you've done over the years?
Some of the work that I've done, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, obviously work that's repetitive. I have done, I've engaged in some forms of therapy in my first career, and certainly I've done counseling with students in my second career, and I'm wondering if something with some form of AI could have done those things. At least the, you know, the when you're doing therapy, you know, well, tell me more about that.
Right.
Or, you know, that kind of thing. And actually, they played around with that in the past, I'm remembering.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I think some of the stuff that I did, yes, it could be. But then I go back to where I come from as well, is not just language and not just inserting the right word here and there, but I also operate on the experience I've accumulated over, I don't know, 60 years,
sure,
etc. And how does a machine do that? Because I will use that experience contextually, different ways, depending on how I'm feeling, how I perceive a student is interacting with me. So those serendipitous type of things, I wonder if a machine can do that. Maybe they can, I don't know.
It's,
not now, but in the future.
We can imagine it, can't we? I mean, because you're talking about experiences that you've had that lead to your ability to do this. Well, we can give machines experiences.
Yeah.
And we can actually give it to them a lot faster.
Yeah, that's the thing.
They don't have to take 60 years to do it.
Yeah. So let's...
That makes me wonder... Can we create artificial empathy?
Does empathy depend on the person who's giving it or the person receiving it? Who interprets what you say as empathy?
That's a good question.
Yes. So... You know, I may be saying something that I feel is quite, you know, has a lot of empathy to somebody else, but the other person may say, God, she's full of it.
Yeah.
So.
Although it'd be sort of weird to be in a counseling session with a machine, an artificial intelligence, and you say something, you know, I miss my cat, and the machine says, yeah, I can relate. That wouldn't feel right, would it?
No. Not to us.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Not to us, but let's say you're a child, and a young child now, and you have your little pet gadget, and you say something to your pet gadget, and the gadget says it back to you, or, you know, says something to you, then you might feel completely comfortable with that.
Yeah.
Now, that may be unfortunate, but I think it happens with some kids. Like, you know, they have their companion, but...
That brings to mind the cartoon strip, Calvin and Hobbes. And Calvin, of course, is completely comfortable conversing with his stuffed tiger.
Yes.
And
I think I was probably completely comfortable communicating with my teddy bear when I was a kid, I thought, you know. But that, again, that's a certain type of thinking.
Yeah.
That's developmental.
Yeah.
So do... machines that do these kind of things, do we put them through developmental phases so they respond appropriately within context? I don't know.
Are you familiar with the book by William Gibson, I Dorney?
Yeah.
No.
Where the cybernaut, whatever term you want to call it, fully machine integrated human, falls in love with an artificial intelligence. and marries the artificial intelligence.
No, I haven't. I haven't read that book.
And it's, you know, it's 20 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Maybe older. But I think you're right, Sharita, that if you grow up in a world full of talking gadgets, which is what's happening, I see my little great niece, you know, at two, reaching for the iPhone, her family's captured in Santa Clara, California, completely surrounded by this stuff. You know, downtown Silicon Valley, if you want to look at it that way, that's where she's growing up. And yeah, it's completely normal for her to just talk to gadgets. And they're not particularly rich, so her friends are literally talking to the refrigerators and their toasters.
Yes.
You know. So yeah, it's easy to imagine that world. But then, makes me wonder about the human component. You know, is there something unique about humans? Not unique in the sense of, you know, like American exceptionalism or anything like that, or Christian exceptionalism, but just unique in a world full of gadgets.
Yeah.
How do we differentiate?
Jaron Lanier wrote, "I am not a gadget," or "You are not a gadget." And I think the overwhelming question we have to ask here is, how does he know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Excuse me, my dog has decided to dig something.
That's, yeah. Just for the record, pets are always welcome in these conferences.
Yeah.
And as they should be. Because maybe pets were our original gadget.
Yes, exactly.
So, and it's pretty easy to imagine an AI that's smarter than a cat, and especially a dog. I'm a cat person, so.
Yes, and I'm a dog. Well, no, I'm both.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm agnostic, but that brings up the robo dogs, which are being promoted as these friendly little pets.
Yeah.
At the same time, they're being sold at weapon bazaars. It's fully armable. Yes.
Yeah.
That's. I saw that just within the past month.
Really.
That. Yeah, they're selling them at the arms, you know, the International Arms Bazaar as a robot that can be armed, and then the question is, can they fire independently?
Yeah.
Of human control, and we're there. It's not. This isn't speculation. We're there. They can be trained to target and fire.
Yep.
Without human intervention. That's a world I don't want to live in.
No, I don't think that's a world that we would want to live in, but if we think about the process that you've just described and what we've hinted at already in this discussion, where younger people become habituated to these artificial forms of life, maybe that's too strong a statement, but these artificial responsive devices that they can develop a rapport with, and then having been raised under that sort of condition, then living in a world where there are these robot dogs with guns, it's in a certain sense not really different to them than police with guns. Like humans with guns, robots with guns, it's all the same to them. And in a certain sense, they're not wrong. You know, especially if you think of the police as a part of society from which we, the rest of us, have become more and more alienated over time. So they really are an other in the same sort of way a machine could be an other. Then it's not so outlandish to think, well, maybe it's not wrong to have robot dogs with guns. It's safer. I mean, we're always talking about the sacrifices that police and the military have to make to protect us. Maybe they wouldn't have to make these sacrifices anymore. And, you know, the issue is, well, they might shoot someone who's innocent, but, you know, that's certainly a problem now. And maybe they might be better at distinguishing people they should shoot and people they shouldn't shoot. And imagine that was the case. Imagine the track record of dogs, of robot dogs with guns, was better than existing police forces. And we have an analogy to draw from, and that's the automated marking of tests. You know, not just multiple choice, but essay-style tests, where there's research that shows that the AI marks more consistently and more fairly.
Yes, but we come from a tradition. I'm guessing the three of us white people speaking English come from a tradition that delineated the authority of God from the authority of peers.
Yep.
And before being executed, we would get to make our case before peers and sort of crowdsourcing the judgment as opposed to automating the judgment. So this is quite a diversion, I would say, from our cultural backgrounds. And then I immediately reach for, once these, and I think we should stop calling them dogs. I mean, they're, you know, they're machines.
Yeah.
And because cutifying is part of the propaganda presentation. But, you know, so there are 2- and 4-legged machines, and I assume there are 6- and 8-legged machines coming. And flying machines are here. And, you know, so anyway, machines.
Yeah.
So as a worker, and I was going to circle back to, could my job have been automated, but maybe that's too far in the past. Once the automation of these machines is fully underway, and we're I think, you know, we're right around the corner from that, you know, 2 years, something. Where these things are going to be mass produced. To me, it's just, we're across the line into authoritarianism, because for the first time, there will be a counter to the mass of people that can be controlled for the central authority. And, you know, even today, there can be mass uprisings that change the course of history by conflicting with what the authorities want. And we are just one step away from that end, where when those with power have 4 billion robots that will kill on command, then, or 8 billion, where are we today? Yeah, 8 billion. Once they have 8 billion robots, then the mass of humanity can be negated.
So, to somehow, in a way, bring it a little bit closer to ethics, so the people that will build those robots that will provide the information for the machine learning, etc. They're the ones that will bring their beliefs or biases into the development of that, those machines.
Okay.
So do we have to go back to what are the ethics involved with doing this? And how would we, as a group of humans, inform those in authority that they can't do that, that they're too biased in that direction? Not sure if I'm making myself clear, but I'm having to, you know, go back, and I'm programming or whatever this machine in terms of the learning that, you know, etc. So it's my values that are going in there.
And, you know, it does raise the general question of responsibility. You know, one of the things that I noticed when I was looking at a lot of these applications of artificial intelligence, I was looking for the benefits or the value produced. Because I thought, you know, that's also a way of thinking about categorizing them. And the descriptions of the benefits or the value produced is very often from the perspective of the manager or the institution or the funder, as opposed to, at least in our domain, the student or the society, the end user, the citizen. Yeah. And it's too bad Matthias Melcher isn't here. One of the things that I've said over the years is that we need to relocate the locus of the benefit from the institutional authority to the individual user. And he raises the question, well, how could you do that? How could you make that possible? But Sharita, you hint at that when you talk about, you know, the people who design them, the people who give them the data and all of that. So maybe there's a route there to finding ethical uses of these applications by looking at how we attribute the benefits of these applications. Thinking out loud here, something like that.
Yeah. But then you would also need to look at short-term benefit versus long-term benefit. Many of the applications or platforms, you know, I'm thinking Facebook, et cetera, that at first were welcomed as, you know, a more democratic way of everybody communicating, et cetera, we now know that there is harm, and it's not that long a period of time.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. It was like 5, 6, maybe 7 years ago, people were saying, oh yeah, the role of Twitter in promoting something like the Arab Spring, and now, today, the role of Twitter in promoting, radically dangerous. And,
there is
that human tendency to weaponize. One of my favorite examples, of course, is abstract art in Cold War. So you're a group of people, artists, just reaching for new means of expression and no intention of cultural domination or, you know, anything like that. And yet, their art was culturally weaponized.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're familiar with that story, Shereen, that, you know, the CIA promoted abstract art.
No.
During the Cold War. Yeah. So, you know, so it's, I use that as an extreme example, but here, I mean, literally paint on canvas can be weaponized culturally, not literally weaponized, but culturally.
Yeah.
And the same thing, you know, with these digital platforms, Zuboff's surveillance capitalism describes how they were weaponized. They were originally a way for college students to find each other across campuses, and then a decade later or however long, are now weaponized to support the rise of white nationalism and other kind of authoritarian political parties.
The we're probably getting off the topic, but the brilliance of something like Facebook, Twitter, etc., is based on social network theory,
mm-hmm.
which literally, encourages these bubbles of people reinforcing their own ideas. Literally, that's what happens when you look at it in terms of social networks. But, I mean, you know, we were all happy with it 10 years ago or so. We didn't always see the bad points. Now we are. So how can we tell? How can you tell now something that you think is, you know, represents your values and you think is ethically correct, etc.? How can you predict that 15 years from now, that won't yeah. be detrimental to what you think of as society? It's really hard.
Yeah.
Here I go with my, you know, my ethics.
Yeah.
How well, do you do it?
That is the course.
Yeah.
So we... go ahead, Mark.
Okay, I just quickly, I see we're running out of time. And so I've always been interested, if not fascinated, by traditional cultures that seem to hold in their culture this idea that progress, as we say in Canada, is easily weaponized. And so by holding on to the original culture and not letting it evolve and change, it avoids some of these problems of more and more modern weaponization. It makes them look primitive or backwards or whatever from our point of view, and yet they typically don't have the means to commit genocide. They may throw rocks at each other or beat each other up, whatever, on some very limited level, but they never get to that next level that we're at. And now we're ready to step into this automated genocide future, I guess.
Yeah.
I'm just glad I'm old.
Okay, well, I think we'll call it at that.
On that cheerful note.
Pardon?
On that cheerful note.
On that yeah. cheerful note. Well, I mean, this is the issue, though.
Yeah.
So, and this is why I wanted to begin with looking at the applications of analytics and artificial intelligence and to look at the benefits and see, you know, what we're getting from all of this. We can easily imagine, and next week we will imagine in great detail, all the ways it can turn dystopian. And that'll be fun. Seeing what we're trying to use this stuff for now, I think is probably a good place to start. And in any case, that's where we're starting. So we'll come back together on Friday at noon for another Zoom chat. So I hope you'll both be able to join me. And of course, one of the things I'm doing is producing videos, and I've got more videos coming. There'll be a task having to do with identifying uses or applications of analytics and AI. And hopefully, if I can get my software working, a kind of classification task, so it's not all writing blog posts. I want to increase the variety of tasks, and I think classification would be fun. And it's interesting because that's one of the things that machines do, and I wonder if humans would do it differently, but that's a separate question. So I'll wrap it up here. Thanks a lot for joining me here, and I'm sure there were people watching on YouTube because we did stream live on YouTube, or they'll watch this recording in the future. And I know that they'll benefit from your contributions to this. Whoops.
Oh.
There we go. I don't know what happened.
Close for a second, Stephen. Now you're muted.
Yeah. Oh, how weird. I'm not sure what happened there, but I think it was the world telling me time to end this puppy. So, All right. Thanks a lot, and see you next time.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye for now.